Folks, we're going to begin even though we don't have a quorum yet. Good morning, Director Emke. If you could identify yourself for the record and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the President and Director of the Minnesota Zoo.
And I'm Mary Robinson, Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Zoo.
Welcome, Ms. Robinson. Director Emke, if you want to give your presentation, can I just a clarifying point? We've passed the deficiency bill, so as your presentation, well, I'm going to assume that your presentation is based on that bill becoming law. Would that be the way you're presenting it?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is our assumption that that will be resolved.
Good, and I think that's as much we need to discuss about that bill today. Go ahead and begin your presentation, and you're aware of whatever your time frame is with Ms. Sipko, I'm assuming so?
Correct.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
Thank you. We're here to talk about our budget for the upcoming biennium. You can see that our request is one that we've submitted to the governor. The governor has recommended, and it will be $8,250,000 a year for general fund operating support. That's $16,500,000 for the biennium. We were here just a couple of weeks ago, and I don't want to go over points that we made then, but just to reiterate, we are a state agency with a fairly unique mission statement. We exist to connect people, animals, and the natural world with an emphasis on saving wildlife. We have essentially three major programs at the zoo, all of which are very interconnected. We provide recreation, education, and conservation for the citizens of Minnesota. And this year, our challenge is to find a sustainable budget that works in the kind of the unique situation that we have as a public-private partnership. We put together a proposed budget that will support our mission and our programs, and one that we believe is financially sustainable. Kind of the key point we'd like to make here is the idea of a two-thirds, one-third share for the operating budget of the zoo. This is one that reflects where we've been in the recent past with our state appropriation. It also reflects the national average for public support for zoos. So we can assume that we can handle two-thirds of our operating expenses through admissions, membership, fees, and other revenue streams. But we're also looking for support from the state of about one-third of our operating budget.
Thank you, Director. Members, I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. I have the minutes of February 17th. Representative Fabian, do you want to move those minutes?
So moved.
Discussion to the minutes of February 17th. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Director Emke, continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, there is a handout that represents the PowerPoint that I'm showing if you need more clarity. It's a little hard to read up on the screen, I realize. This slide just shows our proposed budget for the upcoming biennium, $27 million, $200,000 a year. And it shows the various pots in which our expenses go. As you can see, the majority of the expenses go to the care of our animal collection and the maintenance of our physical facilities. The rest, I think, are self-explanatory. What this budget will support. We are caring for a priceless collection of animals, more than 4,700 in our zoo, as part of this world-class institution that we have here in Minnesota. We have a 485-acre campus. There's 121 buildings and many miles of roads, parking lots, and the like. So in some ways, it's a small city. We're obviously exist to provide an enjoyable and safe experience for about 1.2 million people a year, many from greater Minnesota, I might add, as well as outside of the state. We make efforts to be accessible, and by statute, we actually distribute every year 120,000 free admission passes to serve economically disadvantaged Minnesotans. In addition to being a recreational facility and an attraction, we are the state's largest environmental educator. Nearly 500,000 people a year take advantage of the programs that we offer, both formal and informal. We provide services and work very closely with the schools of Minnesota. About 90,000 children a year participate in our programs. 11,000 of those come to the zoo completely free of charge through programs that are sponsored by our Minnesota Zoo Foundation. We have a Zoomobile program that travels throughout the state and sometimes to Iowa and Wisconsin, providing visits to schools, daycare centers, libraries, and retirement homes, bringing the zoo and educators to the entire state. We're piloting distance learning programs that are virtually bringing the zoo to facilities around the state, even if visits can't be made. And we have one of the most successful camps, summer camps, and actually sometimes winter camps, through our education program as well. So in addition to being a recreation destination and an education center, we are focused more and more on conservation of wildlife. And in particular, in the last several years, we've had a focus on Minnesota wildlife and Minnesota conservation issues, working with partners including the DNR, the University of Minnesota, on a number of projects, including one to restore bison to the prairies of Minnesota, breeding and doing research on endangered prairie butterflies, and very topically, as you saw the paper this morning, working with the DNR and with the university to study the issues surrounding the decline of the moose in northern Minnesota. In addition to that, we work on international conservation programs. 60 of the species in our collection are part of international breeding programs with other zoos called Species Survival Plans. And we support a number of conservation research and action programs around the world, all of which is funded separately from the state budget through the Minnesota Zoo Foundation. We have a reputation, I believe, that is both national and international as one of the leading conservation-based zoos in the world. So that is what the budget supports. These are the expenses within that budget, and I'd call your attention to the large blue slice of the pie. The majority of our expenses proposed going forward will be for the staffing at the zoo. But you can see the other costs as well, all of which are going up, which comes to the point of our current request. And I think in particular we're looking at sort of the disproportionate impact of recent increases in compensation for that employee base that are really impacting the overall rise in costs at the zoo. About two-thirds of our expenses are staff-related, salaries and benefits. At this point, the general fund appropriation is only covering about 30% of those costs. We understand, you know, in recent years there have been, we think, well-deserved salary increases, increased insurance costs and the like, but those in combination over the last 3 years have increased our costs by $1.7 million without any additional state support to cover those new expenses. In addition, some of the other fixed costs at the zoo are going up at a rate above sort of general inflation, and utilities being one of them. We have animal collections that require 24/7, 365 coverage, and our utilities have gone up significantly just in the last 2 years. The weather certainly has been a variable there. And then just the basic animal care components of food, medicine, and the like have gone up fairly significantly in recent years as well. In addition, this budget does consider the fact that not only meeting these basic costs, but that we do need to make some investments in the zoo to continue to operate. Part of our response to revenue shortfalls in recent years has been to significantly cut our maintenance budget. We believe we cannot continue to do that, and we do need to make some investments in the deferred maintenance throughout our park. Serving our guests and finding ways to diversify our revenue streams means that we're investing in a new business analytics system, and we need to do more marketing. That's been another area where we have made cutbacks in recent years to try to achieve a balanced budget. And beyond that, we know we're all aware of in this world that continuous investment in information technology systems is something that we are required to do for security reasons. Increased use of credit cards and the like by our guests means that we have increased costs. So these are some of the investments that are reflected in our budget proposal that's before you today. And this is a point I've made a couple of times, but I think it's important to know that we are our revenues are increasingly dependent on attendance as the proportion of the state share has gone down. But the costs of operating the zoo are kind of independent of how many people actually come. we can have a cold day like today with, you know, 300 to 600 people braving the zoo. It costs the same amount to operate the zoo on a day like that as on a day when we have 6,000 guests. So again, our fixed costs really are one of the most significant things that I want to talk to you about today. So in order to meet those costs, we're proposing a budget that would increase our revenues fairly substantially in the upcoming 2 years. We are going to be growing all of our revenue streams, but this is the proportion that we believe would be will allow us to continue to thrive as the great institution that Minnesotans have come to expect, and actually gets us back to a proportion of state support versus private earned revenue that reflects past levels that we've successfully operated at. The general fund appropriation in this proposal would be $8.25 million, or about 30% of our budget. That would still be below the national average for public support for zoos, which is currently at about 33 or 34%, but it would be a significant increase over the current level, which is 22% of our total operating budget. This slide, I think, really demonstrates the challenge that we've had in recent years. These are the general fund appropriation dollars that have come to the Minnesota Zoo from the state legislature. You can see that as recently as 2009, it was about $7.2 million a year. In recent years, it's been about $5.4 million a year. So there was a significant decline, and then it's been held flat. And of course, during this period, our costs have done nothing but rise, given all the things that I just described. So this is, I originally showed this in conjunction with trend lines with our other revenue streams, and all of the others have gone up. We have increased our earned revenue over this period. We've increased contributions to the zoo, actually doubled it over this period. And we've seen legacy funding, which has been very helpful, but cannot be used for basic operating support for the zoo.
Director Emke, could you remind us, in your legacy funding, do you have an earmark either in the arts and cultural or the parks and trails part of legacy, like some state parks, regional parks, metro parks have earmarks? What's the earmark for the Minnesota Zoo?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I would describe it as an earmark, but we have in recent years received about $1.75 million from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund of the out of the Legacy Amendment. That's been the only source of funding out of the Legacy Amendment that the zoo has accessed.
And Director Emke, for how many years has it been that amount, and has that amount ever changed?
Mr. Chair, it has changed. The initial allocation to the zoo, and I believe the first biennium, was just a little bit over $100,000 a year. In the second biennium, it was about $1.5 million per year, and in the current biennium, $1.75 million per year.
Thank you. And it's out of arts and cultural.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, back to the issue of the proportionality of the state's general fund support, currently at 22%. That's at the lowest it's ever been in the history of the zoo, and that really is the problem. It no longer allows us to manage the inherent variability that we have with things like attendance. We do our best to drive attendance and drive revenues, but many of those factors are out of our control. We don't believe we can increase pricing at this point. We believe we're at the ceiling for the product that we're currently offering. That could change in the future, but right now we don't see that as a viable option for increasing revenue. I mentioned fundraising. The Minnesota Zoo Foundation has, over the last 10 years, doubled the amount of funding it's providing to the zoo, but that is a relatively small percentage of our total budget, so even another significant increase, which we are planning for, will not, in the end, deal with the deficit situation or the ongoing cost pressures that we're seeing. And as wonderful as the legacy funding has been, those are funds that cannot be used to help with our basic operating expenses. Those need to be constitutionally dedicated to new programming. We are planning, however, to continue to be aggressive about growing revenue, and the primary revenue driver for the zoo is visitation. This is a chart that shows our attendance trends over the last 10 years and then going forward. The zoo board has recently adopted a new strategic plan that includes a number of initiatives, but one of the primary initiatives within it is creating a sustainable business model for the zoo, and among the key pieces of that are increasing attendance. You can see that in the past 10 years, we've seen a general increase in overall attendance at the zoo from a baseline of slightly under a million 10 years ago to an average of about 1.2 million. However, what we've seen in the last 3 years is a gradual decline in the numbers, and we are not reaching some of the peak levels that we saw back in 2009 and 2012. We need to reverse that trend, and we have a number of strategies which we believe will do that. But our plan for ongoing growth is something we believe is conservative and modest. It's something we're looking at, you know, maybe 3% a year over year, as we move forward through our strategic plan until 2020.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Emke, and I know you have an association for everything. There's a zoo association. So what do you see, what do your peers see? Are they seeing the same type of enrollment or attendance changes that you're experiencing, or is the Minnesota Zoo an anomaly?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it's really all over the map. We're seeing, you know, some zoos are seeing very significant attendance growth. Others have experienced declines or, you know, modest declines such as we're seeing, and in some situations more significant declines. And it really does depend on individual circumstances. We know that having attractions, you know, new exhibits and new programs at zoos are important for kind of continuing to either sustain attendance or grow it. And there are some institutions that have invested heavily in new exhibits in recent years and have seen significant growth. There are others that have not made those investments and have seen flat attendance or declines. I can't say that there's really a national trend. It's fairly specific to each community and each region of the country.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming there's school group field trips and large group attendance events. Are you seeing a change there? And are those numbers counted in your overall attendance? Like if you have a large event for a school, or you have a number of buses that come versus just the walk-in, are you seeing a change with those? If those are occurring, which I think they are you seeing changes in large organizational attendance?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Actually, that has been a relatively steady. The school attendance in recent years has been somewhere in the 100,000 to 90,000 school kids a year. I will mention that some of that is because we have been able to find underwriters through the foundation to, as I mentioned, support the costs of those trips for schools. Because we know that schools are challenged by transportation costs and the like. But we've seen relatively steady school attendance. As far as other groups, we do have facilities that we rent out in the evening for various social events and business meetings. That declined right after, kind of along with the economy after 2009, but we're starting to see that return as well. And part of our plan going forward is to invest in facilities that would be attractive to that sort of audience as well, to bring in more of those groups and have facilities that will serve them well.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
Okay. As I mentioned, our plan is a conservative one for driving attendance, but we believe we have a number of elements in place starting right now that will assist us with that. We will be reopening Discovery Bay, one of our primary attractions at the zoo that's been essentially partially closed for the last 3 years, with a new Hawaiian monk seal exhibit opening up this summer. We're adding a new privately funded nature-based play area about halfway around our northern trail, which we know will be very attractive to our members, who comprise about 50% of our visitation right now. And we are seeking ongoing capital support both from the state and the private sector for a project called Heart of the Zoo 2, which will continue the reinvention of our main building and add some major new exhibits that we believe will drive attendance. In addition to that, I mentioned the Zoo Foundation has agreed to fairly aggressive fundraising goals to increase their operating support as well as other support to the zoo. And in total, looking at capital funding, conservation program funding, and general support for the zoo, the foundation is committed to increasing their fundraising by 50% over the period of the strategic plan of the next 5 years. We continue to look at other public funding sources for programs such as the Legacy Fund, LCCMR, supporting some of our conservation initiatives and education programming. Again, great additional programming, but not helping with the basic operating support, our operating costs of the zoo. And we are looking at a number of premium programs at the zoo for guests who want to have a deeper experience at the whether it's with the behind-the-scenes tour, kind of backstage pass ideas, or things like a zip line course, which we're going to be hopefully offering this summer. So our basic admission pricing will stay relatively flat, but giving opportunities for guests to do more if they choose, which will drive new revenue for the zoo. And so it comes to, again, our request here, which is built into this proposed budget, would be an increase in our general fund appropriation of $2.825 million a year over the current level. That would bring it to about $8.25 million. As I mentioned, that would comprise about 30% of our total budget, which would be closer to where we were just a few years ago and still somewhat below the national average of support for zoos. This level of increase will address both the past and our anticipated future increases in compensation costs at the zoo, the general inflation that we see, as well as some of those critical investments that I mentioned. And it will allow the zoo to continue to operate at our current levels without having to be overly aggressive with our attendance goals and the like. It provides that balance, that two-thirds, one-third balance that I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation that we believe is the right number, the recalibration that we need to be at. And again, this gets into sort of the long-term relationship. This is a biennial budget request, but looking into the future, we would hope that that idea of about one-third of our operating budget coming from the state as a consistent level of support would be one that would allow the zoo to continue to operate at the high level that we again, the citizens of Minnesota expect.
Thank you, Director. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Emke. I was intrigued by your zipline course, Mr. Chair. I could see some excitement and challenges there depending on where that was located. might increase attendance.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would note that we have talked with risk management about the various opportunities there. We'll have a pretty fun course, but it'll be safe.
Director Emke, how will that be funded? What's your plan specifically? How is that coming forward?
Mr. Chair, that one would be a partnership with a vendor that would who would essentially come in and do a turnkey operation, actually construct the course and do a profit sharing on the receipts. There is some investment by the zoo in the infrastructure to create pathways and restrooms and the like to actually service the spot, but it's primarily an investor coming in to partner with the zoo.
And Director Emke, do you share in any of the revenue that they will get?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Right now we're still in negotiation, but that is the intent is to have a revenue sharing agreement that would generate close to $100,000 in new net revenue for the zoo.
And to Representative Hansen's point, it certainly could drive some attendance to the zoo because you won't be able to use the zip line without coming to the zoo and attending the regular zoo, or is that not true?
Mr. Chair, the strategy we're looking at right now is to actually locate this adventure course, which would include zip lines and other sort of challenge opportunities, outside of the paid area of the zoo, but within the zoo property. So theoretically, one could come and just do that activity or do both. And yes, we do believe it will drive attendance of guests who might not otherwise be coming to the zoo.
Well, and Director Emke, that led to one of my questions I had was, if you could remind members how many acres you have and how many of that really is not managed as part of the zoo property. It's more your outlying perimeter that's more natural. How does that break down? Then I've got a follow-up question.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we have 485 acres that are the zoo property. About half of that is developed for zoo purposes now, both exhibits or support facilities and the like, and the other half is largely undeveloped at this point, although we do have trails that we use as part of our education programs that go into those natural areas.
And Director Emke, do you ever consider introduction of some Minnesota species into those couple hundred acres, maybe in a fenced-in situation? Specifically, I'm thinking of, I think you've acquired 6 new moose in the last year from the DNR study up north.
Mr. Chair, we have not considered reintroducing moose to our property, in part because we have white-tailed deer that have already made that part of their habitat. We have actually a number of species that, including some rare and endangered species, that do utilize the existing natural areas of the zoo.
And Director Emke, would moose not be consistent with those species, are your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, potentially they would not. One of the many variables that we're seeing that's affecting the moose population is the transmission of disease and parasites from white-tailed deer to moose. And so we do need to keep those populations separate.
And Director Emke, you don't need to fence the property currently. The deer are free roaming, and I certainly would think we wouldn't want to allow the moose to free roam. So thank you. Representative Dill.
Thank you, and Director. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you elaborate or re-explain what you said about the 33%, not the percent, but the fact that I thought I heard you say that this would take care of your future needs for pay increases and things and a variety of things. That I just want to hear you say that again so I better understand it.
Sure.
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill. The increase that we're seeking would both address the current increases that we've experienced over the last few years in compensation and the anticipated increases during the upcoming biennium. We're assuming increased compensation and other inflationary factors in this budget.
Follow-up, Representative Dill.
Well, thank you for that. The key word there is in this biennium. Thank you.
Thank you. Director, seeing no other questions, thank you and Ms. Robinson for coming in this morning. We appreciate it. We look forward to working with you in the ongoing session. Thanks, and hope you have a good year.
Thank you very much.
Next, members, we'll hear from the Clean Water Council. Mr. Hansen and Ms. Feichel will come down and run through their recommendations. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Keith Hansen. I'm one of the business reps that sit on the Clean Water Council, and I also chaired the Budget and Outcomes Committee, which provided the recommendations of the full council that we'll be presenting today.
Welcome.
I am Barb Feichel, and I'm coordinator of the Clean Water Council.
Good morning, and Mr. Hansen and Ms. Feichel, will you... You'll walk through your recommendations. Do you intend to highlight the differences between yours and the governor's as you go through, or are you just going to be given yours?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, we do intend to highlight the differences between the council's recommendations and the governor's recommendations. And actually, one of the handouts that you have provides an overall summary, but we will be getting into a little bit more detail on that issue.
Well, thank you both, and thank you for being here, and continue on. Please start.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, what I'd like to do today is just give you a brief overview of the Clean Water Council, its membership, its charges, and then talk a little bit about our guiding principles and funding priorities that we use to establish the recommendations that we will be presenting today. And then get into the detail of the recommendations and show the differences between the governor's recommendations and the council's.
Mr. Hansen, I'm going to ask you if you could just walk through, where's this money coming from? When did you show up? Why don't you give us just a real quick historical perspective of what money you're talking about and where it comes
okay.
from?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. The funding that's coming to the Clean Water Council for recommendations and for final approval by the legislature is coming from the Clean Water Legacy Act, which was, I think, established in 2006, 2007, in that time frame.
Under 2008.
Minnesota's Chapter 114B. And I do have a slide upcoming that'll get into this in a little bit of detail.
You know what, Mr. Hansen, I'm going to step in because I just misled people a little bit. You began to get legacy money in 2008, but actually it was created in 2006 when former Representative Osmond chaired this committee, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was some general fund money the first couple of years that funded, and the hope and anticipation was the possibility of the amendment passing that would create some ongoing funding. So thank you for being correct and for us getting an opportunity to lay out where you came from. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Just from an overview standpoint, the council is represented by 19 governor-appointed voting representatives from a number of different stakeholder groups, as you can see here. There are also 5 agency non-voting members who sit on the council to provide background information and serve a very useful purpose to help the council in its recommendations. There are also 4 legislative-appointed non-voting members. From the House, it's Representative Torgelson and Representative DeRusso. And from the Senate, it is Senator Scalzi and Senator Osmond. And as I mentioned earlier, and the chair is so duly noted, is that the council was created in 2006 under Minnesota State Chapter 114B. And the role and the charge of the council is to basically advise the administration on the implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act. And as it's within your packet, we submit a budget report every even numbered year to the governor and the legislature, and it's those recommendations that I'll detail out here in a few minutes. It's also one of the provisions that are in the Constitution is that, and this is where the source of the funding comes from, is the 33% come from the Legacy Act, of which 33 goes into the Clean Water Fund. And one provision that the council has is that at least 5% of those clean water funds must be spent to protect drinking water sources. In 2014, or 13-14, the council developed our budget recommendations. We developed a set of guiding principles and funding priorities, which I will get at here in the next slide. And we also had several interactions with the various state agencies and stakeholder interactions. So as we developed our preliminary recommendations, we went out to both of these groups and asked for additional feedback. And based on that feedback, we did make some alterations to the recommendations that you're going to be seeing here shortly. From a guiding principles and funding priorities standpoint, we felt that we needed a rule or a rule of thumb or something to shoot for as to what our overall goals and objectives were in developing these budget recommendations. And here, I think, are probably the most important of those is that we wanted to promote programs which would achieve significant new progress towards attaining the goal of the clean water. And I want to emphasize here is that we are talking about programs, not various projects. So we are unlike the LaSarge-SAMS and the LCCMR proposals that end up coming back from a funding perspective. Our major emphasis was to focus on outcomes, looking for improvements in water quality and water resources that would be consistent with the state regulations and laws. The other thing that was a major factor in our recommendations is that we wanted to continue with the implementation of the state's watershed approach. Basically, there's 81 watersheds in the state, and what we're trying to do is get to each 7 or 8 of these watersheds on an annual basis such that for the first 10 years of the program, we can assess all the waters that we have in the state of Minnesota. The other big part is that we wanted to strengthen local capacity, basically to address non-point source implementation activities, provide the necessary technical background for the local that are implementing the various programs that are coming out of the agencies. And another big aspect of it is that we wanted to leverage funds with other available funding that's out there, whether it be EPA funds, other grants or loan programs or state authorized funding. Also, as we go through this, as you'll note on the bottom of the slide here, we've identified where you're going to find these things in the various reports, our progress report that we submitted. Overall, this is what the funding recommendations look like. As you will note here, $135 million is being recommended from the council for basically on-the-ground activities. This is both the point source and the non-point source implementation. This is where we're really going to see our improvements come to rest and help meet those water quality standards that we're shooting for. Another aspect is there's $31 million roughly, or about 14%, which is going to the drinking water and groundwater protection. As I have previously mentioned, our requirement is to spend at least 5% from the statute, and in this situation, we're at about 12% going towards drinking water funding. Another aspect is the monitoring and assessment of surface waters, looking at about $24 million there, or 11% of the total authorized, total recommended budget. This is basically to actually do the assessments. It's part of a requirement from EPA to do these assessments on basically a five-year basis. But as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at a 10-year cycle just to get through it. And that's just basically due to the sheer nature of the number of waters that we have in the state. Another aspect is developing watershed restoration and protection strategies. Little over $23 million, again 11%. This is the development of plans to restore and to protect the various watersheds. And this is a big part of the 81 watershed 10-year process that we're basing our recommendations on. Another aspect is just under $8 million, or 3.5%, to provide technical expertise, tools, and conducting applied research. As I mentioned earlier, again, this is to help the local governmental units, provide them with the necessary tools and implementation techniques to really target where these on-the-ground improvements are going to go. So there is a big part of this that goes towards targeting. The other thing I'd like to note.
Excuse me, I'm going to ask either you or Ms. Peichel to touch. I was wondering how your number could be $221 million, which in my mind it should be around a little over $200 million based on the one-third, with this being about a $300 million fund. Can you touch on the cancellations and why the money is a little bit bigger, or do you want to get back to us specifically on that, or if you could, Ms. Peichel?
Yes, so the latest forecast from Minnesota Management and Budget, when the council came out with the report, it was around $221.6 million, but that includes about $13 million in fund cancellations from the agencies, so money that they were not able to use that would roll forward into this amount. So this is the information that we received from MMB, and now that estimate is about $1.2 million over. The council did decide not to make additional recommendations on that $1.2 million. MMB will be coming out with a further forecast in February/March, so that will be the bottom line, assuming the fund cancellations are approved, that the legislature should use as the bottom line for FY16-17 clean water funds.
Ms. Peichel, do you historically make a supplemental recommendation if it's additional money beyond your MMB recommended reserves?
Chair and members, yes. The council did the last biennium, and this year they did get some advice from their legislative members that leaving some of that money on the bottom line would be a good thing.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Peichel. Will you get us a breakdown of the cancellations in which agencies and what the programs were, so we understand that? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that point, I think it would be good to look at those cancellations versus the requests that are coming in for additional funding.
Representative Hansen, that's right where I was coming from. We're on the same page, wondering if we're funding something that they weren't able to use last time or had a problem with that. So if you could get us that information, we can evaluate it. Please continue if you're ready.
All right, one comment back on the $135 million. As you can see, this is the bulk of the recommendations that the council is putting forward. I think it's important to note that all this is a big number in comparison to the other categories. It's important to note that the need for these funds far exceeds the dollars that are available. And as a good example of that is that under the Board of Water and Soil Resources Surface and Drinking Water Protection and Restoration Grants, we're only funding about 25% of the total requested funds. So this has been that around that percentage for probably the last two or three bienniums. So this is the reason why one of the priorities from the council is to address actual on-the-ground activities. And the other thing that I think is important to note, and it's at the comparison between the governor's recommendation and the council's recommendation, there's 54 programs that the council and the governor's budget addresses, and we are basically hand in hand on about 26 or close to 50% of those. So I'll try to identify where we have those differences here as we go through the rest of the presentation. Point and non-point source, I've already mentioned this to some degree. It basically reflects the policy decision that the council has made is to fund on-the-ground activity because we just don't feel we're getting enough money to go on the ground. And these funds go for implementation of pollution reduction activities, both on the point source side with the wastewater treatment infrastructure, and also restoring eroding stream banks and implementing other conservation tillage programs.
Excuse me, Mr. Hansen, Representative Hansen.
Double Hansen, I guess.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair. I was intrigued on one of your comments about on-the-ground projects because, you know, we have the monitoring and assessment, but I've looked back at the Constitution here, and the language, again, is pretty clear. 33% of the receipts shall be deposited in the Clean Water Fund and may only be spent to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and to protect groundwater from degradation. And at least 5% of the Clean Water Fund must be spent only to protect drinking water sources. And looking through the spreadsheet here, you know, I see BMP development and a variety of targeting, coordinating. I'm okay with evaluating to see if what we're doing is working. But I'm a little concerned when we, particularly on some of the pesticide stuff, where some of this monitoring and assessment and BMP development and nitrates has been going on for 30 years. So I think getting the projects on the ground, we can get the monitoring on the ground, but we also have, and there's differences in the governor's recs versus the clean water recs, but it seems to me that less than half of the actual appropriate pool of money is going to practices that are targeted to change water quality. I'm okay with looking at whether those practices are having an effect, but are we actually getting what the intent of the Constitution was for? Or are we going to spend 20 years developing management practices in the hope that they're evaluated and hope that they're implemented?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen. Representative Hansen, totally understand your concern, and that is something that the council has debated at length over the course of time. The part of the issue is we're trying to supplement the budget as required. The acceleration of these various programs and the development of the BMPs is something that we need to try to figure out how to balance from an overall budget perspective. And that is high on our radar screen as we continue to develop this recommendation as we go forward into the future. So hopefully that addresses part of your concern.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what if we develop the BMPs with the clean water money, but they're not implemented?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I just don't see that type of issue happening because of the driving force from the organizations such as the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Watershed Management Organizations, as they get the grant money or loan money from the state agencies, that there is a driving need out there, and I think there's a groundswell out there to actually do the actual implementation. So.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we still will rely on altruism then to have people hopefully apply the practices, but there may be people who are not altruists who need to have the practices applied but will refuse to do them.
Any additional comment on that point?
No, not at this point.
Thank you. Ms. Pikel, if you could, after giving this some more thought, could you give us the history of all the cancellations since the beginning of the fund over the last few bienniums so we could see whatever cancellations have happened? I'd like to see if there's any pattern or consistency. Continue, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This gets to the question that came out of the OHSAP about how the council recommendations vary from the governor's recommendations. And basically what we're saying here is that there's more funding from the council's perspective to pass through for on-the-ground implementation activities. So the unfunded need is really high, as I've explained, with the 25% from the 14-15 year request. So to me, what the governor's budget has done is it's taken money out of the implementation realm, both point and non-point source, and spread it amongst the other activities, which I think get to some of the questions that we've seen so far, is that we need to spend, from the council's perspective, more money for on-the-ground activities to try to show some overall improvement within the 25 years of the legacy amendment. We're also recommending less funding for the Ag Water Quality Certification Program. Basically, this is a pilot program that's been implemented. We're in year 2 of 4. So the council's feeling that, hey, let's see how the pilot program's going to work out before we start making recommendations to go statewide. Less funding for Department of Ag and DNR programs, where we feel that from an outcome standpoint they're more unclear, so at least some feeling with the council that we need better definition of what's going on.
Mr. Hansen, excuse me. Members, we have the spreadsheet, and it does say it, but just so folks know, it's on the slides, it doesn't show the actual dollar amounts, but you've got this spreadsheet that does show you the comparison. So as you follow, you might want to be looking at both documents. Yeah. Continue, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Another point is that the council did not recommend Clean Water Partnership Program funding for PCA because we felt it was duplicative, and there's some concerns about substitution. The duplicative nature comes from there's a line item for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which also addresses Clean Water Partnership activities.
Mr. Hansen, excuse me. I'm going to actually ask you if you could reference, as you go through them, or Ms. Pikel can maybe help, which page these are so we can be following it. I'd like, because you don't mention the dollar differences, so specifically, if you don't mind, backtrack and tell us where each of these are in this handout, if that works. And you can tag team back and forth. That would be fine. Ms. Pikel.
Okay. Chair and members. So if you'd like to follow along on the spreadsheet, we did start on page 4 instead of the front, just to be able to highlight the non-point implementation programs. So I'll refer to the activity number, which is in the first column on your left side, the bottom of the page. So Clean Water Partnership, you can see that after the description of the program, the council's recommendations are 0. And the governor's recommendations for the biennium would be $3 million. And then if you turn the page to page 5, number 33 would be the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. What other ones do you want me to highlight? And you can see the other, the MDA and DNR programs there. You can see the additional money for some of the Bowser programs, as Mr. Hansen mentioned. I think that's probably, those are probably the big ones. For
thank you. Appreciate that. Continue.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think the last item here is that the council did not recommend funding for Minnesota Department of Ag's vegetation cover and soil health program. However, we have made some recommendations for more research in that area. The governor's proposal deals with the development of markets, and that's basically where what it's centered around, and that council didn't feel that that was an appropriate use of clean water funds. Monitoring and assessment programs basically covers, as I mentioned earlier, the monitoring of surface waters in the state to stay on track with a 10-year schedule. It includes a number of different monitoring activities from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and covers fish and plant communities, addresses mercury levels that are in the waters, pesticides, and also it's part of what they call the 303D list, which is a requirement for Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to identify which waters of the state are impaired. And that gets at the restoration activities that we're talking about.
Chair and members, so this is on page 1 of your spreadsheet, the items in the blue.
And then as far as the differences between the council's recommendations and the governor's recommendations, the council is recommending more funding to support the 10-year statewide watershed monitoring approach, and basically it's to address an increase for large river and sub-watershed monitoring. We also recommend not funding the Minnesota Department of Health Lake Superior Beach Monitoring Program. The rationale for that gets at it's not a statewide effort, and beach monitoring is funded locally in many other regions and parts of the state. So it's basically gets down to the statewide effort, which is part of the charge that the council has in the overriding legislation. We are also recommending no funding for the Minnesota Pollution Control's expanded contaminants of new concern effort, because we think it's duplicative of the Minnesota Department of Health program. So what we're trying to do as we look at all the various programs is figure out how can we minimize the overall administrative costs from various agencies and try to eliminate some of the duplication that may exist out there. This is on page 9 and 12 of the report, and in the document, page 1 and 2, where we talk about watershed restoration and protection strategy programs. This funding is to basically pull together plans at a high level that can be implemented within the local jurisdictions to get at improvements to the existing water quality that's out there, and also has a strong aspect towards protection of the waters. We don't want to see those waters that are currently meeting standards get to a point where they cross that threshold.
Mr. Hansen, I'm going to actually stop you right here. I want people, the committee members, to understand this council's recommendations are treated somewhat uniquely by the governor, in that you came up with recommendations, and either Ms. Pikel or Representative Torkelson, who does serve as a non-voting member on the council, are you statutorily obligated by a certain date to come up with recommendations similar to LCCMR and Lessard-Sams? I notice your recommendations are dated October of 14. Is there a date that you're supposed to come up with a list of recommendations? Ms. Pikel.
Chair and members, the council is required to come up with these recommendations, funding recommendations, as part of their biennial report to the legislature and governor by December 1st of every other year.
Representative Farquharson, to this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to note that the Clean Water Council operates differently than the other councils in that it's an executive branch council. Lasard-Sams is a legislative branch council, so they make their they work under the purview of the state legislature, whereas the Clean Water Council is really the governor's council. And so the reason for, I think, for that date is that the governor wants the information to inform his budgeting process as he assembles his budget recommendations to the legislature.
Well, Representative Torkelson, this is the point I want committee members to be aware of, and you're actually making the point I think I want to make even stronger. I think it's interesting that the governor takes these recommendations and then makes adjustments to them, so this committee has a couple of different recommendations of what path to go down. But yet with Lasard-Sams and LCCMR, we don't see the governor weigh in on if he feels those legislative bodies' recommendations should be tweaked at all. And I just want members to know, I think that's somewhat unique in that it probably increases the obligation of the committee members here to further evaluate those two, because you don't have the governor weighing in or his staff on those recommendations. Excuse me, members. The governor and his staff have clearly evaluated and spent a lot of time on these recommendations, and they're similar in size to Lasard-Sams, approximately $100 million a year, and LCCMR is $40-some million currently. So I just want members to know that here we are looking at these and some alternatives of how much they're up and down, but yet the other two come here really intact, and oftentimes our scrutiny of those is questioned, and so I just want to bring that perspective forward. So thank you. I wanted to make that point because as I'm looking at this, I kept coming up and thinking, this is interesting. We get a chance to look and kind of evaluate the different projects and wonder, is this amount appropriate or not? But sometimes those other recommendations come forward to us and we're supposed to kind of maybe hold them very high in their recommendation. And historically, you talked about some cancellations in yours. We're coming to learn that some of those other projects that we funded with that other money sometimes have questionable results or are not probably have been scrutinized as much as they should have. Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to remind members of the committee that the dynamics here are a little different, as you're expressing, a lot different than the others, and also that the council, you know, if you look at the council membership, it's a wide variety of interest groups that are represented on the council, and it appears to me that the governor's recommendations tend to follow more closely with the agency recommendations. They apparently have more influence on the governor than the council does.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think on the point of the comparison with the councils and the commissions, and I'll go back to what I said last week, is with the Clean Water Council, we actually write the special interests into the meeting, into the body, whereas on Outdoor Heritage or LCCMR, the citizens are citizens that are appointed, and there are legislators that are serving on there. With the Clean Water Council, if you look at the enabling legislation, it must have two of this group, two of that group, two of this group. And they're all of the audience because they want the money. You know, so they're on the council, and they come and then they lobby for the money. Now when we have regular citizens there, you know, they may not have an agenda, or they may not, at least I guess it's clear that there's an agenda when we have the special interests written into the legislation. But I think it's an interesting discussion, Mr. Chair, because all of these things should have some review. And I'll be putting forth a bill. I think it would be interesting to change Clean Water Council to have it just be citizens rather than the special interests that are written into the bill, because we, again, are writing this group and that group and this group and that group into the advisory boards and the authority boards throughout state government. And we shouldn't be surprised when they come forward and want us to just adopt what they've presented to us.
Well, that's a point well made, Representative Hansen, but I think your and my past experience would be that citizens that get appointed to LCCMR or Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage present a resume to either the governor, the House Speaker, or the Senate Committee on Committees, or the Senate Majority Leader, depending on how you want to look at that appointment, based on their involvement in organizations. So it might be somebody that's been active in Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Deer Hunters, or Ducks Unlimited may perceive that that's a good thing to put on their resume, and then when they get appointed to one of those bodies, I think that they certainly seem to advocate for those interests. They may be on LCCMR because they've been active in a environmental organization, and generally speaking, so I see some similarities. This one may have more professional association. The other one might historically be more voluntary and associations, but I still go back to my premise that it's interesting that the executive branch weighs in on the one but not on the other two, and it maybe just again creates a bigger obligation for us to scrutinize where they're at. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's very important to note again that the Clean Water Council predates Legacy, that it was created at a time when the interest groups that are listed here as members of the council were finding it impossible to make any progress on water quality issues because they were butting heads here at the legislature. And it was just, they created the group called the G16, which was a variety of interest groups from a variety of perspectives that sat down and said, you know, we're not making any progress on water quality. We need to come to a table together, bring our interests to the table, because that's what drives all this, and put it on the table and try and work out some ways to make some progress. Citizens have interests, and citizens are members of groups, and it is these groups that drive the conversation, and I think it's proper that they're on this council, and I think it's the only way we're going to make progress in this area.
Thank you. Continue. We digressed a little bit there, but I think it was important for members to kind of get a feel for this as we get closer and closer to moving on our budget recommendations. Mr. Hansen, if you could bring us back to where you're at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the discussion on the watershed restoration protection strategy programs, the council's recommendations, we have less funding for the MPCA's program here. One of the overriding issues that we had is several agencies came in looking for a cost of living increase. Those percentages for those cost of living increases varied across the board from, I don't know, anywhere from 4 or 5% up to probably 12 or 13%. So from a budgeting perspective, the council made a recommendation that we should be limiting cost of living increases to about 5%. This program here is down to 4% because as we got to balancing the budget or our recommendations to come up with the 2221.6, we gave this program a haircut down to 4% from an inflationary standpoint. The drinking water and groundwater protection programs are the yellow coated items, the programs on pages 2, 3, and 4 of your handouts. This gets back to addressing the 5% requirement for the drinking water program that the council has. At this point in time, our recommendations for drinking water are at approximately 12%, so we've well exceeded the statutory requirement to address the drinking water program. Funding here again addresses the drinking water from a monitoring and groundwater perspective, and to address things such as failing septic system. the variation between the council's recommendation and the governor's. We have limited the, again, the pollution control programs to a cost of living increase to approximately 5%. We've got less funding for Minnesota Department of Health contaminants of emerging concern program. There's been a lot of discussion on this program from Department of Health's perspective since I've been on the council, which has been 6 years now. So, and we continue to have questions about how this program has been developed. A lot of the goals are internal to Department of Health, so the council's recommending that we need a periodic programmatic review, peer review of this program. And the expansion of the program in the council's mind is just not justified at this point. Less funding for MDH's well ceiling cost share program. This gets at an issue of whether we're dealing with public and or private wells. The council's opinion at this point in time is that the money should be restricted to public wells or for low-income landowners with private wells. We're also recommending less funding for Met Council's water demand reduction pilot and for MDH's groundwater strategies for local implementation. These are new programs, small, to see it, basically to see if they're going to work. So rather than spend a whole lot of money in these areas, that's why the council has scaled them back. The applied research category is the purple shaded areas in your handout. These funds, as I mentioned, are for technical expertise to help local governmental units identify how best to target where they should be spending their funding. And it also gets at developing best management practices, as we've already discussed, both from a groundwater geology and water use perspective.
Mr. Hanson, excuse me. Representative Purcell has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I didn't get my hand up quicker. To go back here to that previous slide, caught my ear because we talked about it yesterday with MPCA, and it's the drinking water, groundwater protection slide. Bullet point number two, where you talked about less funding for contaminants of emerging concern program. And it's that need for programmatic peer review of the program, and I understand that. But, my understanding, though, is that the contaminants of emerging concern come out of peer review jury journal literature, and so I'm a little confused in what you're going to peer review. And I know you've got some folks on your commission there, committee, council, like Deb Swackhammer, who that's, you know, she lives and breathes peer review literature. So I'm a little confused about what you're going to peer review.
Mr. Hanson.
Chair and members. The council's intent here is not necessarily peer review of what contaminants get evaluated. They want a peer review of the program and the number of contaminants that are getting reviewed. So the council's perspective is that MDH is just choosing a certain number, and the council wants that part of the program reviewed. Because it may be too many, it may be too few, and they want to decide that this is the appropriate level of funding for expansion of this program.
Representative Purcell.
And I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that response. I would just offer to you that your council to give a good leeway to Department of Health here, because we talked about this yesterday, we've got about 80,000 chemicals in commerce today, and we know something about one-fourth of them. And so there's a lot of emerging concern, and I appreciate you prioritizing. I'll look forward to seeing what you come up with on this and your peer review of that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
proceed.
Purcell. So noted. I mean, and this really gets along the lines of the types of discussions that we've had at the full council to really get home to what the points that you've made. So we appreciate that. Back to the applied research and tool development. The council's recommendations provide increased funding for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture perennial cover crop and research program, and for providing more funding for stormwater BMP development around the state. We are not recommending funding for the PCA to address wastewater treatment system design and technical assistance. And the rationale for this is that there are a number of industrial and municipal organizations out there that are specifically designed to do this. And basically, I think a lot of these folks go to those organizations to try to figure out how they're going to resolve their overall problems with meeting the current water quality standards. So basically, we think that these outcomes are unclear, and how this is all going to dovetail together in our mind is questionable. Just from a progress standpoint, Appendix A of the report deals with a lot more of the progress that we've seen to date. I just wanted to point out a couple of them from a monitoring assessment standpoint. By the end of this year, we will have assessed 75% of the water. So basically, on that 10-year rotating schedule, we'll be 75% of the way through that. From a drinking water and groundwater protection, some of the things that have been hot topics lately have been the groundwater management areas, so there's been significant progress on that. Sampling of wells for arsenic and nitrate have increased, and there's been hundreds of unsealed wells which have been sealed under the various programs from the state agencies. From an implementation standpoint, there's been 15 lakes, 20 river impairments which have been restored to meet the water quality standards. And as you can see here, although there's been a significant number of tons of sediment and nitrogen been removed from the environment, we still have a long way to go to try to meet our overall goals within the 25-year of the legacy amendment. So, and then as you see here, about just under 5,000 failing septics have been replaced. But again, the Appendix A of the document of our overall report provides a lot more detail along these needs. Future funding needs. This gets to my point about, although we've had progress, we're still going to be facing major water resource issues by the end of the legacy funds. And this is evidenced by several different documents that are out there. The agencies that develop a Clean Water Fund performance report, which I think gets down to about 18 key indicators on a high level and provides a number of different progress reports that are ongoing across the state. The other thing is the Clean Water Roadmap, which is a recently published document towards the end of 2014. It provides a very high level of the progress that we can expect by the end of the 25-year legacy amendment. And when you look at various parts of the state, specifically the Southwest and the Southeast, we are not going to at the end of the term of the legacy amendment. We will see some progress in the northern tier of the state, but overall the progress has been slow. And that's why the focus from the council recommendations gets that on the ground. We can spend as much money as we want on some of these other programs which do not directly, in my mind, relate to the overall performance. So, and then the other two, there's a nutrient report out there and a sediment reduction strategy. Both outline where we are at and where we need to get. So there's a lot that needs to get done between now and the end of the legacy amendment. At this point, I think I've already made, we need a higher percentage of funds, and I've got a slide upcoming to kind of help illustrate that. And a greater proportion
will be vital to achieve Minnesota's vision for clean water and sustainable water throughout the state. This provides a summary of the since fiscal year 10 and 11, where the council's recommendations have been at, and the final appropriations that have been made, and it's in the non-point and point source and implementation activities. The council has been anywhere from 58 to 65% of the funds that we've recommended should go to, in our mind, go to these point and non-point source implementation activities. And as you can see, what's been appropriated has been less than what the council's recommendations have done. And this is one of our strong points that I think we need to want to bring out. As you look at the fiscal year 16 and 17 year budget, we're at approximately 61%. And within the body of the Clean Water Council report, we're recommending, and we foresee a need that number's got to go higher out into the future if we're going to have any impact on the roadmap and or the Clean Water Fund performance work. Wanted to point out a couple of different bills that are being considered in the legislature. The first one's on inflow and infiltration. This was a widely debated issue at the council. We have decided not to fund it. Basically, it gets at public infrastructure versus private infrastructure, and there are a number of cities, two for sure, that I'm aware of, that have done this on their own, and we just don't feel that it would be equitable to fund some areas versus others. And right now, I think the bill addresses the Met Council and the Public Facilities Authority. The council, I think, is in agreement that if something like this would get funded, it shouldn't go for private infrastructure unless there is a low-income landowner's provision that's contained in that. But I don't know that I don't believe that the existing proposed legislation goes in that direction. So that's why we have not made any recommendations on I&I, so to speak. The other aspect that we also discussed was the Red River Watershed Management Board, the grant funding. The council did not recommend because it's not a statewide program. And there's a number of, like the Lake Superior Beach Monitoring Program, there's a number of other little programs that just do not address statewide implementation. And that it's, when you look at the legislation or the enabling legislation, that is one of the charges of the council, to look at things from a statewide standpoint.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't every practice on a farm private infrastructure?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, that is true. There is a, within each of the agency's programs, there is a ranking criteria that is developed. And the council does look at those from time to time, provides feedback to the agencies, and it tries to get at some of that, where that need and that targeted implementation goes. But yes, you are correct. There is a private aspect from that perspective.
Representative Hansen, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if there was an inflow infiltration problem that was an immediate threat to groundwater, that would be a private infrastructure practice, just like other practices we spend tens of millions of dollars on.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. I think that the precedent is out there statewide that responsibility should resolve or go to those individual areas within the state. And I think that's, like I say, this I&I issue has been debated at length, and it's, except for one of the council members, it's basically a unanimous decision that this got put forward this way. So it's in this situation, we're targeting the metro area, so where is the equity between metro versus outstate? And the other issues are outstate. We've got I&I gets to be an issue on a, it's not a 24/7 issue. It's based on precipitation events. So the overall impact on an annual basis, we don't think it's, from an equity standpoint, it's the way to go.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So $2 million out of $200 million over biennium, the 1%, right? So where's the equity? I mean, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on practices on private land to impact water quality, and you exclude an area because of where it's located, because it's inequitable.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if we're going to do something like this, it should go statewide. I mean, I think that's the position of the council. We could throw $221 million at this issue, and we won't come close to scratching the surface.
Ms. Beichel? Follow up?
Mr. Chair, we could spend $221 million on private practices and not come close to scratching the surface as well statewide. So what I'm talking about here is prioritization. If you had an immediate threat to groundwater from inflow infiltration, not statewide, not everywhere. I think that's the same question that I brought up earlier with protect, restore, and enhance rivers, lakes, and streams and groundwater, isn't it?
Ms. Beichel.
Chair and members, I think the council's perspective was that this is a very important issue, but that funding for I&I should have a couple caveats. It should be available statewide through a program like PFA rather than Met Council, so that folks outside the Twin Cities metro area would also be able to access that those funds. And the other thing is that who's responsible for that private infrastructure? So when I personally bought my home and I had a sewer issue, I had to pay for that myself as a landowner and as a homeowner. And yeah, it was tough. I don't think I would have qualified for low income, but I could pay for it. So the magnitude of this issue statewide is that many people can pay for this themselves. And if state funding is used for this, it should be for those folks who can't pay for it. It should be on a revolving loan fund basis, and it should be through PFA. That is what the council recommended. PFA was not ready. They wanted to look at their existing funds and their existing programs to see if they could do it without even using Clean Water Fund. So I think the council's recommendation is that the legislature talk to PFA about whether they can do things with their existing funds and whether Clean Water Funds are even needed, and if they can do something statewide so it's equitable to everyone in the state to be eligible for those dollars.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, well, the homeowners don't derive income from their home. I mean, everything you said about the ability to pay applies to where we're spending the money on the other practices. But why is that different? There's revenue that they're not only a private infrastructure, they're a business infrastructure. Whereas a homeowner, someone who's on a fixed income, like in my district, who has a huge cost, they're not deriving revenue from that. They don't get a BMP. They don't get the cost share. But they still could be impacting groundwater, and they don't have the ability to pay. So what we do is we provide cost share, technical assistance, and best management practices to private businesses to change their behavior. And that's where my point is, that there's an inequity. If there's a water quality, and I want to be real clear, if there's a water quality issue, which I will clearly understand that there are inflow infiltration. It may not be a threat to groundwater, but there are some where it is.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on this point, you know, as a rural homeowner, I'm expected to keep my septic system in good working order, and in fact have to invest thousands of dollars in a septic system when it needs to be upgraded, as I have recently done myself. So the sewage that leaves my home is my responsibility until it, in the case of a city owner, until it hits the city system. I don't think that's out of line at all. We do have programs that help folks that are short on money or can't pay themselves, but I'm responsible for my sewage in a big way out on my farm. Thank you.
Mr. Hansen, proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think we're down to the last two slides. The other thing that's in the council's report is, for the first time, we've provided some policy recommendations. One gets at the riparian buffers, which you're very well familiar with from the governor's most recent announcement. So we're delving into some of the discussions on policy, because as we develop our recommendations, policy always seems to be coming to the top of the barrel. The other one that we've recommended, or from a policy standpoint to be looked at, is water retention and storage. And here again, it deals with the infiltration issue, but in a different aspect. A lot of these things are part of some of the existing water management plans that are being put together out there. And so I think it falls right along the lines with that. And then finally, the council has provided two resolutions. One is basically an endorsement of the One Watershed, One Plan, the framework for resource planning. This effort will try to coordinate with the number of different plans that are out there and try to come up with one plan for a watershed, as it's pretty well articulated here. The other one is we've adopted some guidelines for aquatic invasive species activities. We think that the Clean Water Fund should be able to provide funding for protection strategies that that's as far as we're at this point in time. So with that, we can take any more questions that you may have, and thank you.
Questions, members? Pretty quiet group here. Any closing comments, Mr. Hansen? Ms. Peichel?
No, we just appreciate Mr. Chair, the committee members, we appreciate the opportunity to come in and present our recommendations, and if there are questions that come up in the future, if they could be directed to Ms. Peichel, that would be appreciated.
Thank you. We know how to reach you. That's anything else, members? Okay. We're adjourned. Thank you.